I realize that by no means have we completed or worked out fully the whole subject of planetary chains. There is very much more that needs to be explored, and as I said last week, quite obviously a great deal has not been given to us. So our information is fragmentary at best. In one passage in the Secret Doctrine, which comes a little bit later, and which we will have to approach in due time, page 185, actually, of volume 2, which is dealing with Shloka 32, HBB takes up again, and we will have to look at this in due time, continually reviewing our own understandings. She takes up again the whole subject of the development through the preceding rounds on this particular earth chain, and she refers the student to Sinnott's work, Esoteric Buddhism. Now, recall, and so I thought I'd just make mention of this, recall that Sinnott's work was really the result of the teachings which he received from the adept teachers, and teachings which are now, of course, available in terms of the publication of the Mahatma letters to A.P. Sinnott. However, there did occur some misunderstandings, as we know, and led to one of the major disagreements that has arisen, perhaps, in this. But his chapter 3, to which HPB does refer us there, deals with the planetary chain. And that particular chapter, which I reviewed again for myself yesterday to be very sure, is indeed quite accurate and places all of this in a very simple way. So I would recommend that if you want to read anything further, chapter 3 is very useful. Now, the chapter which leads to some of the difficulties comes a bit later, in which he is talking about the movement of the human tide wave from in the evolutionary arc, from chain to chain. And it's in that particular one in which he is speaking about the movement within a particular chain, our earth chain. And if you have the diagram that I gave you last week, you can refer to figure 1, the 7 chains of the earth scheme. And as I understand it, and I'll just put this out, and some of you may want to challenge it or correct me or give it another view, which I'm perfectly happy to have explained. The misunderstanding came in terms of the scheme, the Earth scheme with its 7 planetary chains, and the Earth chain with its 7 globes. Now, we have to keep track of this, because there is the Earth scheme with 7 planetary chains, you see, chains of planets, which are given there, and it's very clear if you look at figure 1, you see, that it's called the 7 chains of the Earth scheme. Then you look at number 4, the 4th chain, is the earth chain, named that because the earth is the densest, and it's where we are, you see. And so the misunderstanding that arose, and which, of course, Sinnott has in here, and one has to be careful about, is that Mars and Mercury belong to this chain, They belong to this scheme, but not to the chain, is the way in which HPB later corrects this, or says that this is what the misunderstanding was. Now, there are still those who feel that Mars and Mercury belong to this chain. I think by the law of analogy and correspondence, they cannot. So anyway, one has to work that out. But it's clear that they do belong to the scheme, and they have, therefore, a very, very close connection with Earth, our globe, in terms of the total scheme. There is no question. Now, in deciding today how we would then progress, I thought, at the risk of perhaps too much reviewing, I would hope not, but those of you who feel that it may be, or that you really already understand fully shlokas 2 and 3, I would still go back over them, and we would try to pick this up in a way that I think may now be helpful. But I will again remind you, we are now talking about this particular Earth chain, this particular planetary chain, not scheme, but this chain of seven globes, the densest of which is the Earth. Dense only now, not in preceding rounds. And I would remind you, therefore, that within each chain, and we'll focus only on our chain, the Earth chain, there are ultimately to be seven cycles, or rounds, as they are called in the literature. The English term round has been used. Seven times we go around these seven globes. Now, within each globe, as we are now, and we'll come focusing later, each one, there are seven developmental stages within each of these globes. There are seven of these developmental stages, so that our present position, and this we must never lose sight of, our present position is globe D. Now you're all no longer frustrated. Something is going on the board. Earth. We're here. We all know it, I hope. You see? We all know it. And this is, we have completed 3.5 rounds. Completed. So we are now in the fourth round. Now you see, in any cycle of seven, remember, this is the fourth globe. So there are three globes that have been passed through. We're now on the fourth globe. We're in the middle of the 3.5 rounds, which means we're in the fourth round. Is that clear? 3.5 rounds lie behind us. Therefore, we are now in the fourth round. Or you can say that half of the fourth round is now behind us. A little over half, really, but let's, for purposes now, just say the fourth. But we have, within this, completed four stages, or root races, completed. Developmental stage, or So that's why we are more than half, because we're in the fifth. This means that behind us have been four developmental stages. We have to look at these. Ahead of us are still two more, sixth and seventh, but there are sub-stages, sub-sub-stages. There are both sub-stages and sub-sub-stages, and branches, and so on, you see. So it gets very complicated, I admit. But does this help to identify us? Does that help to place us? Is that, any questions on that? Is that clear? So, in effect, we have two more to go before we even go on to the next globe E, F, and G to finish the fourth round before we return to globe A for the fifth round. Now, this is important because Doug also pointed out, and there are these statements, of the fifth rounders and the sixth rounders. You see, does that help in your question?
Yes. So race in this sense is now a...
it's a developmental stage.
Right. Evolutionary stage.
It's an evolutionary stage. Yes. And it's really terribly unfortunate in light of 20th century thought that because Synod was trying to grope for English words, you see, to express, and the master therefore was using English terminology in order to try to present a very abstruse doctrine for the first time in this language, you see. And it's very clear in the Mahatma letters, our terms are nearly untranslatable. And indeed, we quoted last week that statement from the Mahatma, from the Adept teacher, in which he said, these are your words, not mine.
And those were confusing even to them.
And they were confusing even to, yes, you see. It's like you're trying to learn both a doctrine and Sanskrit at the same time. Mm-hmm. You see. So it's not easy. It's bad enough trying to learn the concept now with English, which we think we all understand. But do we understand what the words mean?
But evolutionary could be construed as being just a physical body.
That's right, you see. And this is the problem.
Consciousness.
But it's a matter of consciousness.
Oh.
Yes.
No.
So these are really developmental stages. We will see that even more clearly, I hope, as time goes on. But there are still, you see, not only some actually, if you want to define it, for by and large, we are said to be in the fifth sub-race. So, by and large, I say, because not all humanity is at the same level in terms of consciousness. Now, this does not mean superior and inferior in pejorative senses. And this, I think, is where we must be very careful. It is not at all to say that poor Jason, for example, who is in nursery school, poor dear, he's not as brilliant as his father. You know, I mean, it's like that, isn't it? To say he's inferior because he's still in nursery school and his father has gone through graduate school, and therefore his father is superior. Well, superior in some ways, but that doesn't mean that Jason is inferior. Would you agree, John? So we have to be very, very careful. We have come to use these terms, superior and inferior, in a pejorative sense, which is really sad. So it doesn't mean that we're all equally as brilliant as Diana. But that we all have this potentiality awakened, and so we move in a sequential manner.
Can I ask a question?
Yes,
of course.
You know, we read about, you know, Atlantis and the fourth race and so forth. Does that mean, you know, that each race has its own world on the earth? Or?
It has, yes, and we'll come to that. That's a very good question, and I hope to get to it today, because these developmental stages are said to have their correlates in continental masses. We'll look at that. Now, we also have to keep in mind very, very clearly that at the time that HPB was writing, there was a certain mindset, certain information was available. And therefore she spoke within the context of what was known both about geology and geochronology. And this is a rather interesting point. Recently, a paper was sent to me which is extremely interesting, and I thought at various points I might read part of it. Some of us remember the Van Heeses, who have been here at the school as students. Well, Hank Van Hees has a background in geology and geological studies, as many of us will remember. And I have been sent a paper which is, in effect, an interview between Ted Davey, who is the General Secretary of the Canadian Section, and Hank Van Hees, dealing with the secret doctrine and modern geology. And it has some rather interesting and very provocative ideas. It's done in this way, as Ted wrote me, because Hank would simply not write an article. So in order to get an article out of him, Ted interviewed him, you see. And as Hank says in this, Ted starts out that it becomes a real problem trying to correlate the references to geological ages with information now available to us, you see. And Hank says, yes, it's confusing, but with a little patience, it isn't hard to make sense of the relative data. And he's worked out a diagram, which I will bring for you to see, and if possible, make copies that you can refer to. But Hank points out that when the secret doctrine was written, geology was a young science, but already getting established. Owing to the nature of the field of research in geology, certain observable facts were quickly obtained and compiled, but their interpretation has only now come to be better understood with additional facts, you see. And there are several passages in the secret doctrine pointing to an uncertainty in contemporary geological dating. And the whole science of geochronology, I'm coming off the point a little, but I think it has bearing here in light of John's question. This whole science of geochronology has been developed really in comparatively recent years, that is within the last 50 years of this century. And there are three interrelated parts to this. One has to do with, and we'll see this later in the secret doctrine, with what are called the strata, the sedimentary rock layers, which have been mapped and classified and so on. And these generally occur in sequence. If you were to cut into a mountain, or even when you cut into the earth, you see layers, you see. And generally, the rule is that younger beds overlay older beds. But that is not always the case. I mean, that's just generally true, that what's on top is younger than what's below. But that's not always the case, because there have been catastrophes, or what are called in geochronology, events have occurred. And events are of an explosive and catastrophic nature. Volcanic eruptions, comets, the impacts of comets, and others that left observable marks, sometimes global, sometimes hemispheric, sometimes continental, sometimes oceanic, which are evident in certain strata, so that you have older strata on top of younger strata. You see. Then, the most difficult one is the factor, third factor in geochronology, which is time. Of course, chronology means time. And this is most difficult. And strictly speaking, as Hank points out, strictly speaking, time may not even be acceptable as a scientific datum. You see. But still the questions are always asked, as he says, when, how long ago, before, or after. Now, one of the things that has been developed is, of course, as we know, the dating through radioactivity of parent-daughter isotopes of a radioactive element. And so there has been what we call radioactive dating, and there have been even developments in this field. Since decay reactions progress at a known rate, the age of the rock is calculated from this ratio of decay, or what is known as radiometric dating. But, as Hank points out, measurements are expressed in years, but don't forget that these numbers are based on a year of 365 plus days of 24 hours. And not taken into account is that the Earth's orbit or rotation may not have been constant over the period measured. And HPB is clear on this, that there has been indeed the reversal of the poles, so that the rotation of the Earth has changed. So we have to be extremely careful in this matter of dating, do you see? When you say, and she does this, crores and crores, you know, the wheel turned for 30 crores, which is 300 million years. Well, our years? Whose years? You see? So one has to be very careful on this. So, and then, of course, now carbon-14 isotopes and so on, but we still put it into our terms, you see, which may not be at all accurate. So we have these continental land shifts, but we also know now a great deal more about these, and perhaps with any luck we'll come to some of these. But I think I've decided it's better to go slowly than to rush through. Is that all right with all of you? So this is our present situation. Now, the shlokas that are presented to us in the very beginning of this second volume, particularly from shlokas 2, 3, and 4 really deal with this kind of reawakening that is taking place as the life wave comes to the globe D, for the beginning of the fourth round, the very beginning. Now, as you can see, in other words, the very beginning of this, after three rounds, before this half realm where we are now. The very beginning. And then shlokas 5 and 6, which are really fascinating, and we won't get to today, but we may get to next week, deal with the period when the globe is just reawakening. Jeffrey Barborka calls it the period of dormancy. I'm not sure that I like that period. It is still, I mean, that term, it is in a sense still dormant, in the sense that no life wave, the human life wave hasn't really gotten there. But it's not dormant in the sense of the earth. The earth is beginning to get itself together, as it were, prepare itself. And so it's a rather interesting stage when the earth attempts to bring forth human entities, conscious beings, and the results are really ludicrous. You know, I get a picture. Now, please don't think that I'm anthropomorphizing this into some chamber, council chamber of the gods and so on, but rather that I get this ludicrous picture in my mind. I have a flair for seeing things, visualizing things. When the gods must have been sitting up there, you know, please don't take it literally, but I can just sort of visualize this, the gods sitting up there, and here's poor Earth, Mother Nature, you know, Gaia, the Gaia principle of the Greeks, you see. Because Earth is a living being. This is a living being we're standing on. Never forget that. It's not inorganic. It's a living being. And here, you know, wanting to develop, feeling this urge to bring forth, you see, having a kind of faint recollection, as we get in stanza 2, a faint recollection that there are such things as conscious beings, you know, just as we have perhaps a kind of faint memory or vision that there is a possibility of being more than we are now. And so Earth is struggling to bring out this, you see, and all that results are these really ludicrous creatures, you see, watermen, terrible and bad, two-faced, four-faced forms, goat men, dog-headed men, men with fish's bodies. And I just can see the gods sitting up there and howling with laughter. You know, maybe that's... But I think they must have had a... Oh, look what's come up now, look what's happened, sort of like, you know, children having fun painting, you see. And if you don't have a real sympathy with them, is that right, Erna? You may howl with laughter, and even if you have a sympathy with them, you have to, I mean, you have to be very careful, but, you know, when they've all gone home, is that right, Erna? When they've all gone home, then you sort of howl with laughter, you see, over what they've produced. And you know very well that in good due time, given some assistance, and this is the key, given some assistance, the child's talent, which at this or very early stage looks like an utter mess, given some assistance, the child may become a Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci or Rembrandt or, you know, Klee or Mondrian or, you know, you see, isn't that right? And this is what had to happen. This is the marvelous thing, that Earth is given some assistance. You've created some forms. You're doing better and better in getting the form together. Now, say the great Dhyanis, the great lords, who have developed consciousness but have not developed form, say, all right, now we'll give you some assistance. We'll help you. We'll infuse. We'll use the form as vehicles but we'll do something with it.
The idea of unfolding, George, of Mother Earth that you're describing is unfolding, but it's not just moving or going round and round.
No, this is
coming in. Moving.
We're now at the very beginning of what you see. I've said where we are. Now where shlokas 2, 3, and 4 are quite preliminary to 2, 4th round, you see, and 5 and 6 are the not just preliminary but sort of awakening. You remember in volume 1 the distinction between stanzas 2 and 3 is a very, very slight beginning. You know, there's a dawning. One is sort of night, not yet, and the other is the very beginning, you know, it's when the alarm clock is rung. The first is like 5 minutes before the alarm clock, and the other is the alarm clock has gone off. It's a very slight change, but anybody who's been awakened by an alarm clock knows the change. I mean, it's definite, but at the same time, it's gradual, you see. And so this is the awakening, the 4th round. Then we move into this marvelous period of when the very first wave comes along, human wave comes along, some see the thorns and say, don't have anything to do with those. Others say, well, we'll sort of get a bit involved. They give a spark. We'll try it out. And some enter. And so you get the 3 classes of monads coming along at that stage. But that's a little bit further along. I thought today we would somewhat review this early stage. This is the very beginning, preliminary. So we're going right back. You say 3 rounds are complete.
Now,
yes.
And that goes to the fact that you told us about some time ago, that the whale made mistakes and the secret doctrine
too. Mm-hmm.
There were 2 or 3 mistakes made.
Yes, there were mistakes made and there were failures. There were failures, you see,
right,
which the Mayan tradition also brings up. And HPB throughout this, and one of the fascinating things in reading, of course, volume 2, is that again and again she refers to some of the legends and myths and so on, particularly, you know, when we get to shlokas 5 and 6, she gives a great deal, you know. They're repeated, she says, in the account of Poimandras, as well as in the Chaldean tablets of creation. She quotes Berosus, and she quotes some of the early Greek, the ancient Greek authors, Apollodorus, Alexander Polyhistor, etc., etc., she says, in the Puranas, and even in Genesis, if it's properly understood. And she quotes many, many of the ancient legends. And this, of course, it becomes fascinating reading, I think, if you can find your way through some of these. But she deals again and again with these early legends, and she says that these legends, these myths that have survived in all the great cultures, the Mayan, the Chaldean, the Egyptian, the Greek, the Puranas of India, these great legends, she says, are not simply allegory. They are facts. They are recollections from the early sages of facts, but they have come down as legends, as myths. And they're fascinating. And, of course, today we read them and science poo-poos them, you see. But I think myself that it is just as ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, for science today to try to explain the birth of the mind simply as the resultant of the formation of the physical brain. You know, and this, of course, remember, especially in the last century, there wasn't any, so far as I can determine, any scientist who was even willing to speculate that perhaps the mind was different from the brain. At least today there are scientists willing to speculate on that, aren't there? Willing to entertain the thought, willing to say that there has to be something different. But, you know, this, for HPB to come out with this sort of thing, but to say that the slow evolutionary process in the development of the essentially human from what's called the hominid stage, the ape-like creature, that suddenly there would be a leap forward in a thinking, self-reflective, fully human man, fully human being emerged, is just ridiculous. So, and I expect to all of us here, that is an utter absurdity. And this is what, indeed, the secret doctrine is saying. Something else had to enter. So rather than saying that the human being is an animal plus something, perhaps the way the secret doctrine would put it is that spirit and meshing itself in a variety of sheaths, then is that plus an animal body through which it can manifest, through which it can operate at this level. So it's a kind of reversal that has taken place. But I think that, you see, in this sense, the secret doctrine, the esoteric philosophy, the theosophical worldview, approaches it from quite a different point of view. We recognize the biological evolution, indeed, and that is present, yes, and that is recapitulated in embryonic stages. We do go through in the growth of the cell, the fertilized ovum, go through stages in the embryonic growth of the physical body where we have fins, fish-like, swimming in the waters of the amnion fluid, and so on, where we go through these various stages. We repeat these. And there are still births, human births, of very strange, that result in very strange forms, as we know. You know, this is true. But to say that that whole developmental process has led to the conscious being that is essentially man is an absurdity, I think. But that is not to say that there is not an importance to the physical vehicle as the carrier of that consciousness. John, you have a question?
Well, an evolving physical being is part, to me, of the earth that's alive.
That's right.
So the living
that's
earth
right.
unfolds as a physical
yeah.
being.
Now, we have to keep in mind that what we think of this globe, this earth, our fourth globe, now in the fourth round, was not the same in the beginning even of this fourth round, and certainly was not the same. So you may want to say, what was this globe like in the preceding three rounds?
but there was a living being, Earth.
That's right.
Before we had any kind of
form. Yeah.
I mean, that's right.
And we are given some clues to what it was like in the previous three rounds. It's rather interesting. We're given some clues, you see. For example, in volume 1, page 259, we have a brief reference to the condition of this globe in the first round. Remember, we're in the fourth round. But what was it like in the first round? She says, in the first round, the globe, that's globe D, having been built by the primitive fire lives, that is, formed into a sphere. Now, those of you who have endured with me through all of cosmogenesis will remember, I think, the action of Fohat is always circular. I think that this has even more meaning today than it did 100 years ago when the Secret Doctrine was written, because there is every evidence that space in its very nature is curved. And so the motion is indeed circumgyratory, which automatically the perfect form is spherical. It's interesting, and this is recalled in many, again, of the ancient legends. Plato, for example, is very definite that the perfect form is the rotundum, the spherical form. You know, and this is perhaps why, maybe by the 6th and 7th root races developmental stages, we'll all be, you know, we won't need motor cars, we'll just roll wherever we're going, you see. Arms and legs will be useless appendages as the appendix is now. And, you see, we'll just be spheres. As I frequently say, there are some of us who seem to approach that stage even now physically, but in any event. So, as she says, in the first round, the globe, having been built by the primitive fire lives, not going back into what these were, but you can easily look that up, formed into a sphere, had no solidity nor qualifications save a cold brightness, nor form nor color. It is only towards the end of the first round that it developed one element which from its inorganic, so to say, or simple essence, became now in our round the fire we know throughout our system. The earth was in her first rupa, first form.
That's very interesting in this Science Journal that came to us yesterday.
Yes.
Dr. E. Lester Smith has an article in which he distinguishes between the two kinds of Darwin theory.
Yes.
The part that is active and the part that is inactive.
Inactive.
And it is on this part that is inactive that the creation of the built there.
Yes.
Yes, it seems that evolution is wrong. So there's going to have to be some kind of a coming together to show that there was some influence other than just the
Yes. Yes, thank you for... It's very interesting, yes, this last issue of the Theosophical Research Journal from Wheaton. Yes. Now, HPB tells us in a footnote, this again is in Volume 1 on page 252, the Earth, such as we know it now, had no existence before the fourth round, as we know it now, had no existence before the fourth round. Hundreds of millions of years ago, the commencement of our geological earth. The globe was, and she quotes a commentary, fiery, cool, and radiant as its ethereal men and animals during the first round, luminous and more dense and heavy during the second round. And then she tells us, very briefly, page 260 of volume 1, that from the second round, Earth, hitherto a fetus in the matrix of space. Isn't that a wonderful analogy? A fetus in the matrix of space. From the second round, Earth began its real existence. It had developed individual sentient life, its second principle. Well, even less is given to us about the third round, although there is a commentary that describes it as watery, but again, not water as we know it. Now, in effect, and perhaps I'll just throw this in here to, I hope, not confuse you too much, we can then see that the rounds, when they reach globe D, and we're not talking about them on globes A, B, and C, or E, F, and G, we're interested in how this globe, because I don't ask me what was it like on globes A, B, and C, and E, F, and G, because I don't know. And HPV isn't telling us, so I don't know, but let me just finish this a moment. If I've been going slowly enough to begin to help you understand what is our present position and where we are starting. Now, I'm not, of course, taking up every paragraph within the Secret Doctrine. I'm expecting that if you really are wanting to pursue this, that you will indeed pursue it. But one of the points, therefore, that we must note very much, and I had suggested we might start back with shlokas 2 and 3, there appears to be not only human memory, you see, but this whole question of memory is quite interesting, because there appears to be a kind of planetary memory, if you want to call it that. The globe remembers, you see. And I think this is something that we don't often think about. In fact, we don't think about it at all, probably. That there is a kind of memory. And so we have these two very interesting shlokas, which I had already dealt with, I think, to some extent in the fall term, in the last series that we had here. But let me just read them, and then we'll comment on them. Shloka 2 said, the earth. Now, this is the earth not as we know it now, please remember, but at the beginning of this round, said the earth, Lord of the shining face, which is a reference to the sun, my house is empty. Send thy sons to people the wheel. And the earth is the wheel. Thou hast sent thy seven sons to the Lord of wisdom. Seven times doth he see thee nearer to himself. Seven times more doth he feel thee. Thou hast forbidden thy servants the small rings to catch thy light and heat, thy great bounty to intercept on its passage. Send now to thy servant the same. There appears, therefore, in this to be a planetary memory that as the earth is awakening at the beginning of the fourth round, that there have been periods when other globes, other parts of the planetary chain were peopled in some way. It's a kind of, just as there is a collective consciousness in which we are all rooted, or if you like, a collective unconscious, according to Jung, which can be stimulated, reawakened, in which, in a sense, we can tune in to any part of the racial memory of humanity. And this is that thesis of Carl Jung's, of the collective unconscious. So So there is a collective planetary unconscious. Again, by analogy, by correspondence, a collective planetary, global unconscious. And the Earth has come to this kind, at the beginning of this round, this kind of consciousness that somewhere else this has occurred. And now do this for me.
You might not know this, and this might be a stupid question.
No.
Is there any cross traveling, cross pollination between these?
There may well be. I don't really know. I mean, I'm not close to the. That could well be. I just don't know. It could well be. But now the Lord of the Shining Face answers in Shloka 3. And this is the answer, you see, that we have to recognize. Said the Lord of the Shining Face, the Sun. That is the Sun as the representative. Now, not the physical sun up there of our solar system, but as the representative of a very high intelligence. Now, we've already talked about the hierarchies, so again, I'm not going into that. We can't continue to repeat, but to a very high intelligence, said the Lord of the Shining Face, I shall send thee a fire when thy work is commenced. Now, this is an interesting statement because fire here, and of course fire throughout, while we have fire really consolidating, as it were, in the second round, not the fire we know in the fourth round, we also have this concept that the very first element, all elements for our system, are rooted in what is known as the fire element. Not fire as we know it, but fire as it gives both light and heat, as is represented by Fohat, represented by a dynamic energy, a movement, as a tattva, as a principle. I shall send thee this when thy work has commenced. In other words, a certain preparatory work has to be undertaken. And we, again, by analogy, can see this in our own lives, I think, in very interesting ways. So raise thy voice to other lokas, that is, apply to other spheres. Apply to thy father, the Lord of the Lotus. Now, the Lord of the Lotus is, of course, the great intelligence presiding over the moon chain, the preceding moon chain, the lotus being a symbol there of the moon. For his sons, thy people shall be under the rule of the fathers. And here we're talking about the Petris, that we are subject to the gift from the preceding chain, the moon chain, which provided us with the chayas, the shadows, the astral prototypes of the concreted form, you see. Thy people shall be under the rule of the fathers, that is, the Pitri. Thy men shall be mortals, and that is indeed what we are, isn't it? The men of the Lord of Wisdom, this is, you see, remember the earth, in this planetary or global, collective, global unconscious, has recognized, has somehow tuned in to the fact that Mercury has already achieved a certain stage. The men of the Lord of Wisdom, that is Mercury, not the sons of Soma, that is the moon, are immortal. But we have to win our immortality. Therefore, we are now mortal. Until we win our immortality, as preceding hierarchies have won their immortality. In one, now, you see, in one sense, You may say, well, that means that there is no immortal part of it, no, of us. No, no. But we as a total consciousness have to win our immortality. And that is again why this is the crucial period. Because having been given assistance, we are now, as it were, left on our own to work it out. And this, remember, is one of the fundamental principles of the esoteric philosophy. There are no special gifts in man save those won by his own effort and merit. We're orphan humanity. But we've been given all the assistance, but, you know, it's as though, you see, you have entered graduate school and you have been given an awful lot of assistance all the way along, haven't you? Tremendous assistance from teachers and so on. A great deal of assistance.
Isn't it only a small section?
What do you mean, Erna? Small section?
A small part of humanity. I mean, you cannot take all humanity into this.
Well, all humanity as we are now in this fifth stage of the fourth globe, fourth round. Yes. You see. Well, in sections, you're right to an extent. But for us, you see, it's as though we, as I say, we're in graduate school. But to get your doctoral degree, there comes a point where there is no further assistance given to you. Isn't that right?
Not to us, but that's a...
Well, I mean, you've got to make it yourself. That's what I mean. There comes a point where you have to do the work. This is what I'm getting at. That where we have now, and this is where we are now, and that's why we're frequently referred to in the literature as orphan humanity. We've been given everything, but our parents have put us out on our own, you say, and you're orphaned. And it's up to us to make the grade, or to be failures. And the possibility is always there. But we may fall flat on our faces and, you know, and that's it. Yes, it does. It does. So, thy men shall be mortals, the men of the Lord of Wisdom, not the sons of Soma, are immortal. And I've always loved this, and I think I've referred to it before in the last series that we have. Anyone listening to the tapes will say, doesn't she ever get off of this? But that's right. But this marvelous, cease thy complaints. Thy seven skins are yet on thee. Thou art not ready. Thy men are not ready. So both the earth and the tidal wave of humanity, neither one is ready to sort of come together. So it's a marvelous statement, you see. But then, yes.
Mm-hmm. When you said that I shall give you fire when you have finished your
work. Work, yes.
Well, then what about the ether fire?
Yes.
Are they sort of parts of that fire?
They're parts of that fire, you see. In a mystical way, they are all parts of that fire. At this again, you see, it's like Thoth with his seven sons.
Yes.
You know, the same terms are often used again and again. Incidentally, in this regard, of course, I refer you again to that wonderful Blavatsky lecture by Jeanine Miller, and I think we still have some copies, perhaps, in the bookstore, The Flame Divine, which goes into this. And you see, the most ancient of the gods in the Vedas, which are the most ancient of the scriptures, the Rig Veda, the most ancient of the gods was Agni. Fire. This was the original deity. And then Varuna and so on, others. But Agni was the original. And that's so interesting. And of course, Jeanine Miller deals with it very, very well in her Blavatsky lecture, The Flame Divine. So now we come, you see, as HPB says on page 46. that archaic scripture teaches that at the commencement of every local kalpa, I like this, local, or round, you see, kalpa is an age, it's one of the Hindu terms for an age, or round, the earth is reborn. And then she quotes the commentary, as the human jiva, or monad, when passing into a new womb, gets recovered with a new body, so does the jiva of the earth. It gets a more perfect and solid covering with each round after re-emerging once more from the matrix of space into objectivity. So again, by analogy. This process, she says, is attended, of course, by the throes of the new birth or geological convulsions. So it's, you see, again and again, this law of analogy is holding true. And so, it would appear that a great number of shlokas are now omitted, and suddenly we come to the fourth round. After great throes, that is, great convulsions, she, the earth, cast off her old three and put on her new seven skins and stood in her first one. And that's shloka four. And as HPB says, this refers to the growth of the earth. Now, as I say, my reason for assuming that probably a great number of shlokas have been omitted is because she immediately refers to a stanza treating of the first round, you see. But she hasn't given us that, really. She's only given us this hint back in volume one. That's why you have to begin piecing things together from the two volumes. But she does quote an occult commentary. This is on pages 46 and 47. Which I think is, I mean, she might as well have given us the stanza, because the commentary is as difficult as comprehension as the stanzas and shlokas. But let me read it to you. After the changeless, immutable nature, that is, essence, sadaikarupa, had awakened and changed or differentiated into a state of causality, and from cause, karana, had become its own discrete effect, from invisible it became visible. The smallest of the small, the most atomic of atoms, or yani yasam, became one and the many, and producing the universe, produced also the fourth loka, our earth, in the garland of the seven lotuses. The achutya then became the chutya. That is, the changeless becomes that which changes. So, as I say, it's a commentary. It's fascinating to read, not as I have attempted to read it, but as you find it there, the growth of the earth. The earliest state, then. Now, what may be noted, I think, is that when a planetary system enters into a period of obscuration, the system's essential substance or essence remains unchanged during that period of dormancy. That's what essentially is being said. Now, it just goes to sleep, you see. And then when the hour strikes, to use the phrase we've had from the earlier stanzas, of course, and the reawakening is to take place, the universal basic energy arouses the sleeping globes and the essential substance is reactivated. So it enters then into a state of causality. I'm looking at Diana because, in a sense, this is karma then becomes operative, this state of causality.
Can dormancy be equated with a minor prolonging?
Yes, oh yes, okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. I didn't bring my first volume, but I have some notes attached in that of the different kinds of pralaya. There are four different kinds of pralaya, but it is a minor pralaya. But the interesting thing is that therefore, there is no, when it's asleep, there is no causality. But the very process of reawakening brings it, she says, into a state of causality. And so from the invisible enters into visibility. Now remember, not visibility as we know it, but from the point of view of the loftiest intelligences who are also reawakened. So they see it, but not with physical eyes. And an interesting point to be noted also is that it appears that the cause of this coming into manifestation of the new globe is described as a kind of cosmic atom, the smallest of the small, but it has a tremendous power to produce the whole system again, to get it going. From the one, in other words, comes the many.
We think of that as the Anu?
Yes, you can. Yes. So that the achyuta becomes chyuta. HPB has an interesting footnote on that, that achyuta is an almost untranslatable term. It means that which is not subject to fall or change for the worse, the unfalling. And it is the reverse of chyuta, C-H-Y-U-T-A. I always have trouble pronouncing that particular Sanskrit term, the fallen. Because the dhyanis who incarnate in human forms in the time of the third root race and endow them with intellect are often called those who fall into generation. And this is part of this.
Angels?
Yes, this is part of the legend of the fallen angels, you see. So that which had existed as imperishable has now become perishable, and the permanent takes on the vestures of impermanency. Now we can recall that in our studies of cosmogenesis, we'd come on the whole description of this emergence of a system from what is termed the laya condition. And this is the same thing. Whatsoever quits the laya state becomes active life and is drawn into the vortex of motion. So with the reemergence now of our earth, the fourth loka, fourth place, was not in the condition which it is now. And it's made very clear, again referring back to stanza 7 in the Cosmogenesis, we had shloka 5, the elements, whether simple or compound, could not have remained the same since the commencement of the evolution of our chain. So that while we identify these, they have changed with each round too. So there is this constant change. So we move then, in this sense, to shloka 5, which now really comes to the fourth round, in this dawning stage. The wheel whirled for 30 crores more. It constructed rupas, that's forms, soft stones that hardened, hard plants that softened. An interesting description. Visible from invisible, insects and small lives, and two interesting words are used, sarisipa and svapada, which refer to creeping and crawling things. She, that's the earth, shook them off her back whenever they overran the mother. After 30 crores of years, she turned round. She lay on her back, on her side. She would call no sons of heaven. She would ask no sons of wisdom. She created from her own bosom. She involved watermen terrible and bad. Now, I think we might pause, though, and recognize that the earth is said, of course, to cast off her old three skins. This refers to the preceding three rounds. She has to cast these off, just like the serpent, you see. And she's passed through these. And at the beginning of every new round, says HBB, page 47, after a period of obscuration or these minor pralayas, the earth casts off her old skins. The seven skins in the first of which she now stands refer, says HBB, to the seven geological changes which accompany and correspond to the evolution of the seven root races or developmental stages of humanity. And this raises some very important questions, and that's why we might pause at this point to note what she gives then as these seven geological stages of our particular round. Because I think it's important to recognize this, to see if we can make sense of it. Because basically the major question concerns these seven geological changes, you see, that she stands in the first. And what evidence there may be for certain changes that have already taken place or may be said to have taken place. Our starting point must be where we are now, in the fifth developmental stage, in this fourth round. So I've left that there. Fourth round, and in the fifth developmental stage. Four and five. So we have to recognize that. So what are these changes? That should mean, then, that at five geological changes have taken place. Changes associated with the rise and fall of continents, and therefore with the conformation of land masses during previous ages. Now, HBB names these continental land masses associated with each developmental stage. So let us look first at the information she gives us, but don't jump to any conclusions, particularly in regard to identifying past continents and land masses too specifically, because there have been many changes in geological theory in the past years since she wrote this work. Although, as George was reminding me during the break, she very carefully describes the Mid-Atlantic Rift very much as science now knows it, doesn't it? Isn't that what we agreed, George? Yeah, what you were saying.
Yeah.
So her description is really quite incredible. But I think we have to be very, very careful on this. Now, the first continent which she identifies, which would be the first root race, she calls the imperishable sacred land. A rather interesting term, imperishable sacred land, Adivarsha, and she identifies it thus. This is volume 2, page 6. Because it is the only one whose destiny it is to last from the beginning to the end of the Manvantara throughout each round. According to poetical expression in one of the commentaries, the pole star has its watchful eye upon it, from the dawn to the close of the twilight of a day of the great breath. The only one whose destiny is to have to remain. Now, many have sought to identify this imperishable sacred land, and there are many articles that have appeared in the Theosophist in various places, and E.L. Gardner has written on it, and have sought to identify it with a specific geographical location on our planet. But I have come to be convinced that it is not that. I remember Fritz Kunz used to talk very many times about this and say that it had to be some part of the globe on which there were no fossils, because fossils are an indication that that had once been under the waters. But if we refer to the first of the propositions which HPB gives us at the outset of our studies of anthropogenesis, the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different portions of our globe, I think we can suggest that for the appearance of those groups, as it were, there had to be a loca, a field, a sphere of manifestation, but not a physical continent in the sense that we now know it. For those groups constituted, in fact, D. Peruker says, they constituted seven embryonic astral humanities. And therefore, this sacred, imperishable land, which whose destiny it is to endure, is, as it were, a sphere of activity, of action, which is not physical, but in which consciousness is grounded, if you want to put it that way. And so these shadowy humanities had their zones on this imperishable sacred land, which was said to extend like the leaves of a lotus southwards from the North Pole in seven different zones. So I would like to propose, I mean, after all, others have written on it, I don't see why I can't propose something too, even if I'm not going to commit it to writing right now. I'd like to propose that this first continent was not really a continent at all, but constituted the entire globe in its ethereal or astral shadowy condition, the entire sphere. And consequently, it is indeed imperishable for the entire period of this chain. It will remain certainly without, throughout this round, even.
Is that why in the first round they put ether?
I think so.
Because it can't be anything,
it can't be anything physical at that level, right. You see. And so, and it yet remains. It is always there as the form. And it's perhaps even becoming the, it becomes even the mold or basis for the reactivation of the planet at the beginning of each new round. So it's not only the, for the first of the fourth round, but it's the first and the enduring one for all seven rounds then, and constitutes the etheric mold for Globe D, for the entire system. Now, does that make sense?
The word globe means etheric mold.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's where I've got it now.
What about the pole star? What would, is that called the attention?
I think that's, yes, I think so. And that becomes the magnetic link that holds it within its orbit, as it were, within the total scheme.
It's also the yardstick that we measure the round by.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, solves the problem, you see.
I've merely
No, nobody can. But people can go on, you know, saying no joy is
I waited for an hour to hear you say it, you know.
I've got horribly ignorant questions right now.
Good.
Everybody's still brainy. You talk about simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different parts of the planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the word evolution should not be there, but the simultaneous appearance of these different groups as the prototypes of the slow evolutionary stages that will take place. In other words, that there is at once implanted in that primeval matter which we've called Akasha, but within the archetypal mind, if you like, of these seven types that will then be expressed through the long evolutionary stages.
That would be the seven atoms.
Yeah, well, the seven classes of monads.
But they don't appear simultaneously.
Well, what appears simultaneously is the prototype, the archetypes of them, if you like, or prototypes. That's the way I feel. And it's on the portions of this sacred, imperishable land that correspond to that which will be developed. So again, those are the areas, as it were, of the sacred land, which are prototypes of that those continental masses which will later be made manifest. Just see if we can get a little bit further. The second, she calls the Hyperborean. Continent. And she states that its promontories extended southward and westward from the North Pole to receive the second root race and comprise the whole of what is now known as Northern Asia. And her description is really quite beautiful of this. She says, such was the name given by the oldest Greeks to the far-off and mysterious region whither their tradition made Apollo the Hyperborean travel every year. Astronomically, Apollo is the sun, who, abandoning his Hellenic sanctuaries, loved to visit annually his faraway country, where the sun was said never to set for one half of the year. But historically, or better perhaps ethnologically and geologically, the meaning is different. The land of the Hyperboreans, the country that extended beyond Boreas, the frozen-hearted god of snows and hurricanes, who loved to slumber heavily on the chain of Mount Ripheus, was neither an ideal country, as surmised by the mythologists, nor yet a land in the neighborhood of Scythia and the Danube. It was a real continent, a bona fide land which knew no winter in those early days, nor have its sorry remains more than one night and day during the year, even now. The nocturnal shadows never fall upon it, said the Greeks, for it is the land of the gods, the favorite abode of Apollo, the god of light, and its inhabitants are his beloved priests and servants. It's a beautiful description, isn't it? Beautiful. Well, there's still much of mystery here, for as a land of the gods, then that identifies, by analogy, with the Petries and the fashioners of our present humanity, and therefore again cannot be an actual land mass so much as a particular inner region adapted in its material or substance to the still far from physical humanity during its second developmental period. So that these two, this which lasts throughout the entire system, this which is identified with the second race, you see, by analogy, still cannot be physical, because the first two developmental stages are not yet in the physical form as we know. Well, then, of course, we go on to Lemuria, Atlantis, our present continental landmass. She identifies this, however, more specifically Europe and America. And then 6 and 7. I think those more particularly Australia and New Zealand are part of the Lemurian, yeah, to keep in mind too. Now I think, well, our time is going, so I think I'd like to talk more about these further, because one of the things that I think we have to keep in mind, and I'll start next time with this very much, is that now we come to geological shifts which can be historically verified. And that means that we have to be extremely careful in light of current geological theory of the tectonic plates, that what is now known is that certain portions of our present land masses are much older geologically than other portions. And consequently, we may need to rethink, I think, rethink, or at least reinterpret, much of our former thinking about these continents, particularly Lemuria and Atlantis. So I'd like to leave that for next week, and let's take it up from there and then try to get us